ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, the Israel-Lebanon ceasefire extended for 3 weeks as thousands of Lebanese civilians return home. Also, should Australia build a new oil refinery? And preparing to honour our Anzacs, meet the woman who'll proudly lead the march in Darwin alongside her horse.
It's a huge honour to be escorting past and present diggers, especially as a civilian. It's pretty amazing.
First tonight, Donald Trump says he has all the time in the world to reach a peace deal with Iran. The US president has scoffed at suggestions that he's anxious to end the war. The comments come as a stalemate continues over a possible second round of peace talks, with Iran not yet committing to attending. Speaking at the White House, the president said he wouldn't be rushed into making a deal.
So we were in Vietnam like for 18 years, we were in Iraq for many, many years. We're in for all the, I don't like to say World War II, because that was a biggie, but we were 4.5, almost 5 years in World War II. We were in the Korean War for 7 years. I've been doing this for 6 weeks.
Donald Trump was speaking after announcing the extension of a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon after ambassador-level talks in Washington.
We had a great meeting with the very high officials of Lebanon and very high officials of Israel, and we think that the president of Lebanon and the prime minister of Israel over the next couple of weeks will be coming here. They've agreed to an additional 3 weeks of, no firing, ceasefire, no more firing. Let's see.
While the extension of the ceasefire is a positive sign, the agreement doesn't include the Iran-backed Hezbollah group, whom the Israeli military has been targeting in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel traded attacks in the hours before the talks in Washington. Despite the volatile security situation, thousands of Lebanese civilians displaced by the Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon have been returning home. UNICEF Global spokesperson James Elder has been travelling throughout southern Lebanon. He's now back in the capital, Beirut. I spoke to him a short time ago. James Elder, you've just returned from southern Lebanon. Where did you travel and what did you see?
Yeah, we went way down to the south to Tyre and then further on into a hospital. We saw a lot of devastation. I had colleagues there who were there 2 weeks ago who were stunned, Lebanese colleagues and foreigners, because 2 weeks ago, you know, the homes and the hospital were in perfect condition, like you would expect them to be. And now they were going through rubble and devastation, and homes and a library that had all been floored. The hospital had come under fire. There was only one patient now in the hospital. The people have been forced to flee. Everyone wants to go home, Rachel, but at the moment they either don't trust it or they've been sent photos of their home, which is now dust.
There's been a ceasefire in place since last week, but Israel and Hezbollah have continued to exchange fire since then. How dangerous was it when you were there?
Oh, I mean, nowhere safe. I think that's a reality for people across the region at times. People feel that. I think particularly here, irrespective of a ceasefire, because of course, you know, in that area 36 hours ago, Rachel, a journalist, was killed. And I met her photographer. She was the only person in the hospital. Very bad head wounds, you know, very big hospital, but everyone else has been forced to flee. So people are well aware of how perilous things are.
The announcement of the first ceasefire triggered a wave of people who had left to return to southern Lebanon. We saw pictures at the time of people returning in their cars with their belongings. Have numbers grown in terms of people coming back?
Without a doubt. I mean, we've still got hundreds of thousands of kids in shelters, Rachel, and again, shelters, displacement, they can sound like soft or neutral language. It's not, you know. Being displaced is violent. It's often repetitious. There's no dignity about being in a shelter. So people want to go home, but a lot of people are aware that their homes aren't there, or they're in an area now that Israel has moved into in southern Lebanon and is fully occupied. So, you know, I met a dad yesterday, Rachel, and he's desperate to get his kids home, but, you know, he lost cattle in September 2024 when through Israel strikes, and this time around he borrowed another $50,000 on the back of his property. He bought cattle, They've all been killed. His home's been leveled. He showed me videos of the bulldozers going through, and he's seen all his crops destroyed, all looted. So, yeah, there's a very real, it's not a cliched connection people have to the land, but either they can't access it or they're returning to rubble, or in many cases, if they can get back, they'll go and put a tent up where the home used to be.
You mentioned that people are staying in shelters. What is the humanitarian situation like right now? What do the people who are making that journey back need?
They need so much. I think that something a little bit different the last 6 weeks of the airstrikes has been just the amount of civilian infrastructure hit, all the things that children rely on. So it's water systems, schools, hospitals. I mean, we've seen 100 health workers killed. So they're not returning to the level of safety that they need, and they're not returning to the things that they need. So schools are still closed. I guess they walked around the rubble of a library. I know that sounds small, but, you know, for families and for children and people without big incomes, that's what they use. People use libraries. That's a place of your knowledge. So everyone remains feeling a little bit like their lives have been turned upside down. The humanitarian need certainly now eclipses what it has previously. Then you've got one agency like mine, UNICEF, and we are less than one-third funded. So a double whammy for families here, Rachel. On one hand, they're seeing constant breaches to international law and impunity, so it means that they don't feel safe. On the other hand, they've seen abandonment by donors, and so they don't have the things that they need. And these, you know, Lebanese, they're tough people. They're like Australians. They live off the land. They're used to doing things by themselves, but you see your crops destroyed or your cattle killed and your home floored, oh, you need some support.
Are the people of Lebanon hopeful that a lasting deal can be reached?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think Lebanese are well aware of the political realities in their country and their region, and they've seen ceasefires breached time and again. The ceasefire that came after September 2024 was breached. So, yeah, they hold on to hope, but they need international law to hold, they need accountability, and they need an end to this endless impunity, if you will.
James Elder, thanks very much for joining PM.
Thanks, Rachel.
And that's UNICEF's global spokesperson, James Elder. While the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, the fuel crisis will only intensify. For now, the Australian government says our fuel supply remains assured. The Prime Minister says we've got 46 days of petrol in reserve. And today, the government announced it had secured a further 100 million litres of diesel. But what about the next crisis? At the moment, there are only two oil refineries in the country. One was damaged by fire earlier this month. Some are asking why we don't have more capacity. David Sparks takes a look.
Despite the ceasefire, there's still precious little movement in the crucial Strait of Hormuz. Gero Ferrugio heads up Rystad Energy Australia.
Well, what we know about the flow from the Strait is pretty much what you see in the news at the moment, and blocked seems to be all you hear on that. That's the bad news. But the good news is that the Asian refineries, those that typically provide Australia with all its diesel and jet fuel, has managed to secure crude either from elsewhere, and they've actually to date been managing to operate at normal levels.
But after nearly 8 weeks of war, a massive volume of oil has been taken out of the global system. And eventually, that's going to take its toll.
So this is why only now you're starting to see the impacts on those Asian refineries. In fact, today and over the next few weeks, those refineries are looking to be at, say, 20% lower than what they were doing typically.
Just over 20 years ago, Australia had 8 oil refineries, which were able to meet most of the country's demand. Now, there are only 2. It's led some to call for the country to build another refinery, providing more backup next time a crisis hits. Among them is Chief Executive of the Viva Energy Refinery in Geelong, Scott Wyatt, who says Australia would benefit from having another, more modern refinery. And in New South Wales, Premier Chris Minns says he's open to the idea.
I think that's a discussion that we need to have as soon as we solve this acute problem in our marketplace at the moment. I'm open to having refining capacity in New South Wales.
Queensland Premier David Crisafulli wants an oil refinery built in Gladstone, where one company has put forward a proposal for a new $11 billion plant. So, should Australia invest the enormous sums of money needed to build a new refinery? Gero Ferrugio again.
Most of these refineries around the world are actually losing money, and losing a significant amount of money, because the crude oil is so expensive and the product hasn't gone up as much. Can Australia build another refinery? Well, the point I made is that those refineries are losing a lot of money at the moment. So if we did build one, it wouldn't be commercial. It would have to be government subsidized, not just for building it, but probably to maintain it. And the second thing is we just don't have the quality of the crude to produce the products that we need, the jet fuel and the diesel.
But other experts think Australia should support the construction of a new oil refinery, even if it's not profitable. Professor Yuan Chen is with the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering at the University of Sydney.
My feeling is we should. The answer is that this is like a bioinsurance. It's costly, but that gives some security in the end.
Can an oil refinery in Australia run at a profit? Or would we need to accept that it would probably run at a loss and the government would need to subsidise it?
Is this really depending on the crude oil price, as well as the overall efficiency of how the plant is run? But again, based on the earlier answer I have, so this is basically a bioinsurance plan.
Greg Bourne is a councillor with the Climate Council, but formerly the regional president of BP Australasia, with a long history in the oil industry. He has a blunt assessment on whether Australia should build another oil refinery.
No, definitely not.
He says building a third refinery doesn't necessarily protect the country during an oil shortage.
So basically, if you think about it in terms of, you know, what's actually happening, so combination of crude oil and products are not coming out of the Middle East, not coming out through the Straits of Hormuz. And so basically, that choke point is a choke point. So it basically comes down to, yes, you could build a refinery which could refine crude oil, but you still can't get the crude oil if the Straits of Hormuz are closed.
The federal government has this week denied reports it's held discussions with energy companies about building a new oil refinery.
David Sparks reporting. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. A decade after Papua New Guinea's HIV epidemic was thought to be declining, the country is struggling to deal with what the government has declared to be a national crisis after a surge in new cases. Advocates for those living with the disease say the resources needed to raise public awareness and get people tested have dried up. And vulnerable communities like sex workers say the stigma around HIV remains a deterrent to treatment. Here's our PNG reporter Belinda Cora.
The Barocco Centre in Port Moresby is a hotspot for sex workers. And here, Sylvia Pork, a sex worker for more than a decade, meets male clients.
The men that we go out with is risky and it does become dangerous, especially at night. A lot of time we are attacked and some almost killed by these men.
Despite the threat of violence, it's not the only risk these women face. PNG is today grappling with a surge in HIV cases. There's almost 200,000 female sex workers in PNG and almost 359,000 male clients.
I don't care if he is giving me a large sum of money for sex, but if he refuses to use a condom, I refuse sex as well, because my life is also important and I'm doing this to live.
In 2025, PNG declared a national HIV emergency with over 11,000 new infections. There's over 120,000 people living with HIV in the country, although that number is thought to be much higher. Melanie Pilili is the executive director of IGAD Hope, an organization that provides support and services to people who have contracted the virus.
I think we went close to 200,000 condoms that were distributed. And surprisingly, most of those that came to get the condoms were pregnant women or mothers or females. Most of the women were spouses of men that were working remotely, or they know of their spouses having extramarital affairs. Out of fear of them contracting HIV, they wanted to ensure they had the condoms on hand.
She says a lack of funding remains the critical barrier to expanding their work.
A lot of members who would love to go out and do the awareness activities, but we need money to support with logistics. Yes.
The main sources of funding have been international donors. But funding cuts, including the withdrawal of US aid from PNG, have accelerated the epidemic. PNG Health Minister Elias Kapovore says the government is trying to plug the gaps left by the withdrawal of foreign aid and is calling on the public to do its part.
The increasing number of HIV in the country is due to the fact that People are not doing enough public health awarenesses, and people not knowing their status. There's a lot of unprotected sex going around in the country.
Sex workers, advocates and health workers all agree that the toughest challenge for people living with HIV is the stigma. Sex worker Trina, who asked we don't use her real name, is a trans woman, says her community has been discriminated against by health services.
Sometimes they're not really friendly. Those that are sensitive, they treat us well. Others who aren't just ignore us, walk and look at you and giggle off to the side and just keep walking.
Tessie Soy is a social worker and one of PNG's well-known advocates for people with HIV. She's worried the epidemic is once again getting beyond the control of health authorities.
We're battling, you know, all the posters, the billboards, you know, they're not there anymore. And the numbers are increasing. As we see the cases that come into our hospital.
But believes there is still a pathway forward.
It can be stopped. Yeah. Let's keep whoever is positive, let's, you know, look after them. But through our education, our awareness, our compassion, we can stop HIV.
PNG social worker Tessie Soy ending that report by Belinda Cora. It's one of Australia's most successful sporting teams, yet our national wheelchair rugby team, the Steelers, doesn't have a major sponsor. Wearing the green and gold in Adelaide at the World Challenge this week, the Steelers are not only hoping to impress spectators with the fast-paced, physically demanding game, they're also hoping to lure the right backer. Kimberly Price reports.
It's a good defence. Robinson in there as well. Awesome, tough going.
Wheelchair rugby teams from around the world have arrived in Adelaide for the World Challenge tournament. Crowds swell at the State Basketball Centre to cheer on the competition.
A lot more strategy. It's like a sort of a basketball cross rugby cross chess.
The clash of metal is not great for parents in particular.
Super intense, you know, like the bangs and like when they hit each other. It was crazy.
I play football, so I'm all about the physicality.
And I think lots of people who like doing bumper cars would like it.
Steeler Robin Lambert spoke to ABC Adelaide about the team's preparations.
Yeah, we've got a great team here. The vibes, some of the best I've seen around. So, yeah, we're feeling confident.
In wheelchair rugby, males and females compete on the one team. Robin Lambert says the fast pace and physical contact of the game is intense.
Yeah, I first started playing when I was pretty young, so I was pretty small and scrawny. So coming up against someone like Riley Batt was definitely intimidating. But once I got into that environment and started to know all the players, it just becomes like a family.
Over the years, the Steelers have become a sporting success story with numerous accolades to their name. But at this year's World Challenge, Australia's national team is also hoping to pick up a major sponsor.
The Australian Steelers have brought home
gold medals, world championships, endless trophies.
And currently, no major sponsors.
Part of staging the World Challenge is to bring elite competition to Australian shores and put the Steelers front and centre.
Chris Ney is the CEO of Wheelchair Rugby Australia. He admits the absence of a major sponsor could be solved by simply getting the word out.
We've got one of the most successful Paralympic or Olympic teams Australia's ever produced in our midst with the Steelers. But often our competition is sort of overseas in European time zones or US sort of time zones, and the nation isn't as aware of the team as what they probably should be.
Chris Ney says the Steelers are happy to wait for the right sponsor to come along.
There's no opportunity cost in not having it because we don't have one on the jersey currently now as well. So we're really confident that we continue doing what we're doing well, and all of that stuff hopefully will sort itself out down the track.
Major sponsorship can be transformational really for financial certainty, elevating visibility and also support in athlete pathways.
Dr. Ashley Morgan is a professor of sports management at Flinders Business School. She says traditionally parasports have been underfunded and undervalued by sponsors, but that's changing.
There's huge opportunity. So there's reach that organisations haven't previously been able to have, and we're increasingly seeing brands see the value in that, the commercial benefit for them. So as well as, you know, committing to a sport and showing authentic impact, they're actually seeing commercial benefit too, and that is definitely growing.
Wheelchair rugby is also a growing sport. The World Challenge marks the first time that Kenya will compete at the professional level. Lydia is the Secretary General of Wheelchair Rugby Kenya.
We're very excited. We are happy to be here. We've learned a lot through the whole journey. We hope the lessons that we've learned here will take with us back home, and we'll continue the sport back there.
The World Challenge runs until Sunday.
Kimberly Price and Angus Randall reporting. Tens of thousands of people will gather to mark the 111th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings tomorrow at ANZAC services across the country. In doing so, they'll honour all Australians who've served our country. But it's not just our diggers who'll be front of mind. In Darwin, the march will be led by what's known as a whaler horse. Tanya Dendrinos prepared this report.
It's very emotional on the day.
It's impossible to ignore Jeanette Wilson's passion. Since 2004, she's been honouring Australia's light horse troops and their steeds, leading Darwin's Anzac Day march.
The crowd often give a really warm applause for the horse. It's like they don't want to scare the horse, but they want to acknowledge that they appreciate. The crowd's amazing, the beautiful warm applause that they give us just to acknowledge the appreciation. You know, respect to the diggers, respect to the effort that's gone in to present the horse with original artefacts. It's a huge honour to be escorting past and present diggers, especially as a civilian. It's pretty amazing.
If her dedication isn't already abundantly clear, each year on the 24th of April, Jeanette refuses to sleep. She's too afraid of missing her pre-dawn alarm.
The first horse I did the first march with in 2004 was Noble Comrade. I retired Noble Comrade from marching in 2016, and his son Ravelli has taken over.
Jeanette's horses are known as whalers.
Australia being Australia, they nicknamed everything. The soldiers nicknamed them the Whalers because they left from New South Wales. The Australian Whaler horse was preferred by the British military because of their smooth gait.
Ravelli will be adorned with a number of war relics during tomorrow's Anzac Day march, many of which have been donated or purchased by Jeanette from families of Australian servicemen and women over the decades.
I do believe this is an original World War I military issue sword. That's an original World War I military issue helmet. These are original World War II leggings that were donated to me. They're 1939. And same with the spurs. They're original World War I spurs that were donated so that I can display them on Anzac Day.
Nigel Allsop is the president of the Australian War Animal Memorial Organisation.
About 136,000 whaler horses left Australian shores in World War I, and only one called Sandy ever returned.
Why do you think it's so poignant that to this day it's not just our diggers who are remembered during Anzac commemorations?
Well, look, I started the Purple Poppy movement with the RSA in New Zealand and the British Legion in the United Kingdom getting permission to utilise the Purple Poppy as a sign of respect for our four-legged diggers. I mean, without sounding sort of remotely funny, you know, the famous Charge of Bathsheba, which Australian horsemen are famous for. Well, without the horses, it would have been the brisk walk to Bathsheba. You know, they are very much an essential part.
Nigel says there's been a cultural shift when it comes to respect for animals.
Animals were just modes of transportation that pulled the milk cart. You know, they were the utes of the day. And now people, pet owners, people with horses, people with dogs, there's a lot more empathy, I guess, for animals, and the fact that they suffered in the trenches and wars. They heard the same shells. You know, over 9 million animals died in World War I supporting Allied forces, ranging from the horse to, of course, one of the most forgotten heroes, which we couldn't have done without, was the messenger pigeon.
A fact not lost on Jeanette Wilson.
We will remember them, lest we forget.
And we wish horse trainer Jeanette Wilson all the best for tomorrow. That report by Tanya Dendrinos and Shane Schaefer. That's PM for this week. PM's producer is John Stewart. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a great weekend.
Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As a nation of travellers, the Iran war has created huge uncertainty over whether we can still go ahead with our holiday plans and how much more it's going to cost us to fly. Today, aviation expert Ian Douglas on where things currently stand and what to expect if the war doesn't end soon. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.